Creating Change with Doug Foresta, a show dedicated to creativity and emotional healing. Creating Change on Empower Radio.
EmpowerRadio.com.
Here's your host, Doug Foresta.
Thank you everyone for joining me today. This is Doug Foresta at Creating Change, and welcome to, actually I brought this show over from Blog Talk. So for any of you who are listening, or all of you who are listening from Blog Talk, I really appreciate you joining me. If you're a new listener, or if you've been listening to Imagining the Future, which was the other show we had on Power, I welcome you, and we're going to be talking about Creating Change is about creating, is about just about that, and about the connection between creativity and change, both personal change. And today we'll be talking about one thing I think is sort of the having a social imagination about the connection between social change and personal change. And so we'll be talking with Dr. Joseph Ranka, who is a professor of social work at Springfield College in Massachusetts, and he's permanent representative to the United Nations in Geneva for the International Association of Schools and Social Work. He's also a Fulbright scholar and social justice, poverty, and human rights author. And he is the author of, among other books, Human Rights and Social Justice. And Dr. Ranka, thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for doing this, Douglas.
Thank you. And I also want to say that, also in full disclosure, that you, I probably took, I went to Springfield College, and I probably took, I think, 4 or 5 classes with you. So your thinking has really informed my own work, so I really appreciate that.
Great. Hope it's in a positive direction. Well, I imagine it is. So,
absolutely.
Human rights stuff is not—it's not easy to do sometimes. You kind of get grief sometimes. So, hope you're hanging in there. Well, I could talk about some of this. So,
sure.
Well, it's so like when I say things like sometimes I say, well, you know, they have healthcare in Europe or healthcare in Cuba, and some of my friends say, well, move there. I mean, I don't know. I just said they have health. They had free health care. Well, it's not free. It's paid for by taxes. But you kind of get grief for some of this stuff. But anyway, good to see you again, Douglas.
And thank you. Same here.
Okay. All right. So go ahead. Shoot. We're all set. Okay.
Absolutely. So maybe I thought what we could start with is when people think about, you know, human rights, they might think, well, this is, you know, this would be a nice thing to do, or if I had time. And I thought maybe we could bring this down to sort of the level of sort of the individual level about, let's say, for example, public, you know, how people feel, or you know, let's take it down to levels of, let's say, for example, making the connection between people feeling there's a lot of depression and anxiety. People sometimes might be listening to this and might feel depressed or anxious. And maybe you could sort of talk about the connection. What does human rights or human rights culture, what would that have to do with sort of how people feel on an individual level?
Yeah, well, first of all, just for your viewers, one of my things is having a human rights culture. If I could put a little, I have a website called humanrightsculture.org, and it talks about what we need in society as human rights culture, which I defined as a lived awareness of human rights principles.
Yes.
In our minds and our hearts, and dragged into our everyday lives. So I feel if we had this human rights culture, my personal feeling is it would do a lot to cut down on depression, to cut down on anxiety, and also violence, domestic violence, violence against children. So the question is, well, how is this possible? Well, first of all, when people hear about human rights, they think about things like FGM, okay, female genital mutilation. They think about the terrible things that Saddam Hussein, all this stuff that he did, the terrible things that went on in China and Tiananmen Square. And nowadays, you hear about the terrible things, the mercy killings in Afghanistan, you know, children being forced to marry at age 11. Things like that. Well, all that stuff is actually terrible stuff, but my question is, you know, why was female genital mutilation on the agenda only when we invaded Somalia? Why now do we hear about all these atrocities in Afghanistan when we're in the war? This should have been there there before. But anyway, I'm sort of going around.
Well, I'm wondering if you could say a little bit what a human rights culture is. Could you say a little bit about what you mean by human rights culture?
Yeah, it's like I say, it's a lived awareness of human rights principles. The word culture comes from the Latin cultura, which means the tilling of the soil. And it's principles like that should be lived. They should be taught in grammar school. They should be taught in high school. They should be part of our culture. Just for example, when you think about human rights, you really should think about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which actually was drafted under the able leadership of an American, as you know, Eleanor Roosevelt.
Right.
And the United States was a major leader there. And people don't know this, but the United States was pushing rights to work, rights to adequate shelter, rights to rest and leisure, rights to health care. And getting back to your initial question, Doug, what would a human rights culture do to cut down on anxiety and depression and things like that? People don't know it, but like I just said, in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, the right to work is there. And the right to work means, okay, not as it's defined by conservatives, which is, I don't know what, union busting or something, but the right to work, in the opinion of the United States delegation, when the Universal Declaration of Human Rights was being drafted, meant socially useful work that contributes to the development of the human personality,
right,
purchasing power. And my mentor, who was David Gill, I don't know if I should say this on public radio here, but
you can say it.
All right. He was co-chair of the American Socialist Party. He doesn't have horns or anything. He's kind of a nice guy. He also won a Lifetime Achievement Award in social work. David Gill was also one of the world specialists, actually. He's spoken on international conferences on violence against children. And one of the things he found was that a lot of violence against children is committed by people that either are unemployed or they are underemployed. In other words, and they lack collective bargaining in the workplace. In other words, nowadays, a lot of anxiety that people have is that they could lose their job. I don't know, their boss hires their niece or their nephew or something, or is in a bad mood or something, and they can get fired. I mean, this is a terrible type of thing because people have mortgages to pay and things like that. And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says that people have a right to collective bargaining. They have a right to air their grievances. They also have a right to a job. They also have a right to security in the event of unemployment. So if we had a culture that had all these things, I think that we would definitely cut down on some of the depression and some of the anxiety that we have. And I'd also like to say cut down on all these old people that are in prison. I mean, the prime predictor of landing in the slammer is unemployment. This has been shown again and again and again.
Absolutely.
Okay. I don't know, are you with me? Am I talking like a professor, talking too much? I don't know.
No,
can I just
not
say one
all.
More example, Douglas? Okay, just one more example.
Not at all. I want to interject real quickly just to say that, you know, although you had mentioned, for example, David Gill being, you know, the co-chair of American Socialist Party, that I think one of the things, though, that and you write in your book, Human Rights and Social Justice, you talk about an exercise where where you could sit down and have conservative, liberal, and radical groups talk about how could we implement human rights. And then, in fact, there's not, and this is something that I really like, is that we shouldn't exclude conservatives or people that have, it's not about being a socialist. It's about, there could even be other ways and creative ways to implement these things.
I agree 100%. And I don't know, believe it or not, there's something very conservative about this stuff. I can't put my finger on it. Like a lot of my friends, I mean, they're very conservative Republicans, but they're compassionate, they're good people, but they're dealing with the same problems that everyone else is dealing with. Their kids can't get health care. They have this tremendous tuition in colleges that they have to pay for their children.
Right.
They're afraid of losing their jobs. And so this human rights stuff kind of appeals, I don't know, to conservatives, liberals, and you know, even radicals in the sense of socialists. I don't really think this is any far out leftist crazy Marxist kind of stuff.
Right, that people should right, yeah. That people have jobs and that we treat each other with respect and that absolutely. And that's what I love about it. I mean, that's what I love about it, because I myself do not personally I feel at least that we need to have a social imagination that can encompass that there may be different ways to get at the same thing. But if we can agree that we want to get to a certain place, even if we like, that can be a creative challenge too. It can be a creative challenge of maybe there are different ways that, you know, each group may have some ideas that can contribute to the public good.
Yeah, exactly. And I just would like to add to that is I like to call it the constitutional imagination.
Yes.
And there's a whole school of thought that says the Constitution is a living document, and we need to imagine how the Constitution could adapt itself to our current times. As you know, some of the work I did, I compared the federal Constitution with the Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Yes.
And the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is people have rights to rest and leisure, people have rights to jobs, a good education and rights to health care. I mean, all the things that conservatives want, liberals want, I don't know, socialists want. And I found tremendous, you know, gaps between the two documents, the federal constitution and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But if you look at phrases in the federal constitution, the Equal Protection Clause, the clause in the preamble to protect the general welfare, and you sort of have some kind of imagination, well, what, you know, what could we do? And then you use human rights as a guide. I think we could start thinking that, hey, we can get a lot of the rights of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and just put them in the federal constitution. And that's all you got to do. Well, you know, I kind of have this Father Sarducci. I don't know if you're remember Father Sarducci.
Yes, Saturday Live, yeah.
Yeah, Father Sarducci approach to social justice or something, where things aren't really that difficult. I mean, all you got to do is get the rights of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then you got to like put them into the federal constitution, and there you go, and everybody happy, you know, that type of thing. So, I guess I just kind of elaborated maybe a bit too much, but I think it's true. We do need an imagination. Social imagination, like you say, but also a constitutional imagination where we can actually, you know, change our basic laws of the land. We tried it with the ERA, Equal Rights Amendment, and we got nowhere. But, you know, got to keep on trying.
Absolutely.
Keep on trying.
You know,
yeah. Well,
what I love about this, too.
Question. Yeah.
What I love about this, too, is I don't know if you know James Hillman, the psychologist. Jungian psychologist, he has a book called We've Had 100 Years of Psychotherapy and the World's Getting Worse. And that's that's not surprising to us in social work because we, you know, because we study human behavior in the social environment. But it's kind of a radical concept, I think, for people to realize that, you know, some of their sadness or anxiety or may actually come from living in a, you know, it may come from their social environment, and not we tend to locate problems within people.
Right, I agree 100%. When actually, it, you know, it's a societal issue.
So I wonder, one of the things too, I was wondering if we could talk a little bit about is you also mentioned, I think this is a great sort of ties in. Then you talk about creativity in here, social entrepreneurship, and one of the things you talk about again in the book, Human Rights and Social Justice. You talk about how that. The idea of human rights is strong enough to encourage, I'm quoting this, to encourage risk-taking and social action that literally goes to the ends of the earth. Social entrepreneurs are creative, tenacious individuals with unshakable motivation to propel the innovation needed to tackle some of society's most serious ills. I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, social entrepreneurship is basically kind of, you know, getting your act together and just, you know, doing whatever it takes to take in some of the gaps that government, actually, theoretically, government should be doing some of this stuff.
Right. You know,
getting hold of some of these gaps. I mean, there are some people, for example, at least in, in Massachusetts, we have a lot of talk about having gambling casinos here. And as far as I'm concerned, gambling casinos basically leave trails of family breakups, bankruptcies, things like that, foreclosures. There are some people, just by way of example, they're anticipating these casinos coming in, for example, and then what they're trying to do is develop centers that could help people deal with their gambling addictions.
Right.
But then again, there are some people that are saying, hey, we don't need more casinos. We simply need more jobs. And as you know, many Native American nations, I like to say nations, you know, they get caught up in this stuff, but basically it's marginalized groups that get caught up in occupations and doing things like that. At least that's my, I guess, not so humble opinion. But social entrepreneurship means basically, you know, taking a social problem and running with it, trying to do the best you can with it, and trying to get grants to go forward with this. The only problem with that, at least in my view, and we discussed this in class a while back, I guess, if you recall, a lot of the money out there and a lot of the grants are basically given for so-called reactive policy, for things that are kind of downstream. Like my example before of the right to work, for example. You couldn't get money, you could get some kind of grants to open up a center to deal with parents that abuse children, to deal with children that have been abused, how to counsel them. You know, that's great stuff. But try getting money to add a right to employment on the U.S. Constitution. You just ain't going to get it, you know? So social entrepreneurship is great stuff, but the problem is the money that you get for that is sort of more reactive. It deals more with the symptoms of an unjust order. Like I said in class on numerous occasions, I mean, social justice is a struggle. There's just no way around it. You got to deal with symptoms, but you also got to deal with causes. So I'm all for social entrepreneurship to, let's say, set up a homeless shelter, you know, get money for that, you know, try to get the home off the streets into a, you know, a nice place to live and try to get them a job. And that's great stuff. And people should be doing that stuff. But on the other hand, what we should also do is try to have a right to shelter added to our constitution, or if not our federal constitution, our state constitutions. I mean, like Supreme Court Justice Louis Brandeis said a long time ago, states should act as laboratories of democracy. To put rights in their constitutions that we may not have in the federal constitution, you know, we're not really doing a good job of it. I mean, I read all 50 constitutions, and believe me, there's nothing that speaks of the right to shelter, the right to work, the rights to health care. So my feeling is, in one fell swoop, you should basically just simply get all the rights of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and kind of put them in the federal constitution. But the problem is, a lot of them making sense, but I'm kind of going on and on here, but I feel I'm making sense. Social entrepreneurship is great stuff, but we also have to not only try to help the homeless, try to help kids, obviously, but we also have to prevent these things in the first place. And one of the ways to prevent them is, I think, by having amendments to the U.S. Constitution. If you don't mind, I could bring up the C word here. My listeners will still listen. But capitalism, you know, has a lot to do with this.
Sure.
We have to have alternatives to this. And because it sort of encourages sloth, I think it does anyway.
Well, maybe if I can just interject a moment, just want to share sort of the practical application of this, you know, in terms of you know, when I work with people in therapy One of the ways in which, because I don't think that one precludes the other. So one of the ways in which, for example, you know, cognitive behavioral therapy is a big thing. You know, it's like the gold standard. So somebody comes in, let's say, and they're, you know, I've had this, for example, somebody comes in and they were in a gang and they have post-traumatic stress disorder or they have whatever it is. I might teach them some cognitive behavioral techniques just to help them so that they can function internally. But then we start to talk about, you know, how did you end up why did you end up joining a gang in the first place? You know, and they say, well, because I didn't have many opportunities, you know, and the neighborhood I lived in was really ravaged. And what ends up happening is as people feel better, a big part of their feeling more empowered and feeling more powerful, they may then get involved and start, they may get involved. You know, I encourage people to get involved in organizations and groups that do social entrepreneurship or, you know, get involved in your community. But at the same time, then they can start thinking more upstream and saying, well, maybe I also need to get involved on a more, you know, on a larger scale level with human rights culture. And so I think that it can become a spiral of healing for people that you can start with, okay, I'm starting to feel better. Now I want to do more. Now I'm getting involved in my community. Now I'm getting involved in my state. Now I'm getting involved in my government. So it can become, I guess, sort of just as a practical application of what you're talking about.
Sounds good to me. Yeah, sounds great, actually.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that so that, you know, when people listen to this, so they don't think, well, that's all great, but there's nothing I can do. You know, there's nothing I can do about it.
No, there's a lot you could do about it.
Right.
And gangs, by the way, Gandhi, well, he used to work with gangs, and his grandson worked with gangs. A lot of people work with gangs. You know, when you talk to them, a lot of the qualitative research on this is you ask them, you know, well, what do you want? What are the basic problems? And inevitably, almost always, they say we want to have good jobs.
Right.
And I don't know, gangs of the world order unite and put pressure on government. I mean, just to create good jobs, or I don't know.
Sure.
Nonviolent actions
Well, I always look at it, the way I look at it is when someone, let's say, is a leader in a gang, that means that they have leadership skills they could apply.
Without a doubt. Yeah.
I want to make sure unfortunately the time has gone so quickly, but as we're coming up to a close here, I want to make sure, first of all, if people would like to learn more and get involved, first of all, I want to make sure they can visit www.humanrightsculture.org, correct?
Yes. Yeah, I got a lot of exercises there. I got a lot of resources. Also, I have some stuff that I've been doing at the UN. At the UN, we're trying to get a convention that governments will abide by to eradicate extreme poverty. I've always felt strongly that, like Jimmy Carter said when he got the Nobel Peace Prize, that poverty was at the bottom of all this. So there are resources that they can go to. Plus, if you go to Amazon, I did have a list on international social work and human rights. I have a list of readings there that also might be.
Yes, and I want to make sure, too, that, you know, also the book that we're talking about, and of course my guest is Dr. Joseph Ranka. The book is called Human Rights and Social Justice, Social Action and Service for the Helping and Health Professions. So if people who are listening to this, either maybe in therapy themselves or maybe are some type of healing or health professionals, that this book actually is written with that in mind, correct?
Yes, it's basically written for helping and health profession, for the helping and health professions. I mean, you don't necessarily have to be a professional, I mean, to read
right.
it. The book is for every person, but at the end of each chapter, I do have social action activities that people can engage in, and then questions for discussion. So I have, there's about 35 social actions throughout the book that people can engage in. That, by the way, are a lot of fun, but they're also kind of risky. When you do these things, and you know, and actually gangs might like doing this stuff. I don't know, like having a reading of the rights of children or something like that.
Absolutely. Yeah. What I'd love to do, if it's okay with you, is I'd love to have you back, and then Maybe if you'd be up for it, we could go through some of those exercises. We could talk a little bit about what those exercises are. I think people would enjoy that. I know I would.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about them. I'd love to talk about some of the stuff we did and the effects that we had. As you know, I lived in Alaska for a while, and December 10th is International Human Rights Day. And we had a reading of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and it was literally 40 below in Fairbanks.
Wow.
And we're all holding candles, and people were saying, well, who are these idiots? I mean, they must really believe in what they're doing. And they do, actually, you know. And when people see the commitment and dedication, you know, it kind of spreads, actually. So, sure, I'd love to come back and go over some of those social actions.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Doug.
Okay. Thank you. It's always a pleasure to talk with you, and I look forward to continuing the conversation.
Okay, same here. And, okay, thanks again. And thanks, everyone.
Take care.
Bye now.
So thank you, everyone, again, for listening. This is Doug Foresta at Creating Change, and we have some great guests for you. And again, we're going to range from everything from, we're going to have more, we have upcoming guests we'll be including, we're going to have stuff on overcoming addictions, dealing with trauma, dealing with relationship issues. So we're going to have a lot of practical advice and a lot of great experts talking about different things. So thanks so much, everyone, for listening. This is Doug Foresta at Creating Change, and look forward to continuing the conversation with all of you as well. Thanks so much for all your support, and as always, thanks so much to Brent Carey and to all of the great folks in Empower for making this possible. Take care, everyone. Remember, keep creating. The world needs your gifts.